listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, back from Germany. A couple of funny stories to tell. And this Friday, I'm going to be in Las Vegas as one of the speakers at the National Trial Lawyers Association. Many, many thanks to Dr. Mike Newcomb for filling in for me the last couple of days while I was in Europe and for getting ready to fill in for me for a couple of days later this week. But I am here today. I'll be here for the first hour tomorrow. And Bernie Sanders is with us right now. Senator Sanders, last Friday you were in Los Angeles on the Bill Maher Show. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. Do we have you for the hour, sir?
I think we can do that.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. So we'll make today the official Brunch with Bernie day for the week. So, boy, you've got a lot on your plate. I understand you delivered a couple of million petitions to the White House. I called the White House comment line this morning and said no to the chain CPI. What's going on?
What's going on is that just a couple of hours ago, we had a rally with the AARP and other senior groups, and the AFL-CIO has been very strong on this issue. All of the veterans organizations have been strong on this issue. The National Organization for Women has been strong on this issue. And what people are saying is that a moment in American history when the middle class is disappearing, when so many people are struggling, you know, to pay their rent or their mortgage, to buy the food they need, the health care that they need, now is not the time for the president of the United States, elected by many of these people, to be talking about making rather significant cuts in Social Security and benefits for our disabled vets. That's wrong. It's wrong public policy. It is not what the American people want. The truth of the matter is I think most of your listeners understand, we are in the deficit situation we are in now. And by the way, we have made real progress in lowering the deficit in recent years. But we are where we are now because of two unpaid wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, and most importantly, the Wall Street-caused recession, which has resulted in a substantial reduction in revenue coming into the federal coffers. Right now, Tom, as I think many listeners do understand, corporate profits are at an all-time high. The wealthy are doing phenomenally well. And we must not balance the budget on the backs of some of the most vulnerable people in this country when you got one out of four major corporations paying zero in taxes, federal income taxes, when you have at the federal level corporate tax rate at 12% is the lowest that it has been since 1972. So, yeah, we want to move toward deficit reduction, while at the same time we must create the millions of jobs our people need. But we cannot balance the budget on the backs of people who are already hurting. We must not cut Social Security or benefits with disabled vets. And let me tell you something. Don't let anybody fool you by saying, oh, well, this is just a tweak. It's just a way on how we calculate cost of living increases. We are talking about in 10 years, if you're 65 today, you will get $650 a year less. And by the time you're 85, you'll get over $1,000 a year less. When you're trying to live on $15,000, $16,000 a year, that is a big hit. And if you are a disabled vet, over a 30-year period, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars less that will be coming into your pocket. And that's not a way you treat those people.
And none of this is going to balance the budget. And none of this could easily be solved by simply letting rich people pay into the Social Security funds the way the rest of us do.
We have legislation in that would lift the cap. I hope most people know that right now somebody who earns $113,000 a year contributes the same amount into the Social Security Trust Fund as somebody who makes $10 million. And that's wrong. And if you lift the cap, and we would start at $250,000, you can make Social Security solvent for 50 years. Right now it is solvent for 20. So I think that is the direction that we have to go.
So what else is going on in the Senate?
Well, the other thing, we had an interesting press conference today on another issue that we need to spend a lot of time understanding and talking about, and that is Wall Street and the role that these large financial institutions have on America's economy. along with Congressman Brad Sherman of California, I introduced legislation today that would break up the largest financial institutions in this country. We all remember 5 years ago or so that Congress bailed out, not only bailed out Wall Street, but also the Fed provided some $16 trillion in low interest or zero interest loans to the largest financial institutions in this country and the largest corporations. Now, people will be surprised to know that 5 years after we bailed out the Wall Street banks because they were too big to fail, each and every one of them is today much larger than they were before we bailed them out because they were too big to fail. Now, that's pretty crazy stuff. So what you see now is the top 10 financial institutions today are larger than they were when we bailed them out because they were too big to fail. There is no reason to believe that if we are faced with another similar financial meltdown, that the taxpayers of this country would not once again have to bail them out. But the issue is beyond that. The issue is concentration of ownership and concentration of power in America. Today, just looking at the top six financial institutions, these institutions have assets of $9.6 trillion. That is equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America, controlled by six financial institutions. They write two-thirds of the credit cards in this country and half the mortgages, and they, of course, control some 95% of the derivatives written in this country. So you have a few financial institutions with unbelievable economic and political power. Wall Street, to a significant degree, in my view, has become a gambling casino whose function in life is to make money for people who have invested or work on Wall Street rather than is the grease to expand our economy and create jobs. In other words, instead of seeing Wall Street investing in the productive economy, the companies that manufacture products or provide services, they have become an island unto themselves, making money for themselves. And unless we get a handle on that, I don't know how we're going to see the middle class start to grow again.
Did I see that David Vitter joined you in this?
David Vitter is working with Sherrod Brown on legislation. It's a good piece of legislation, and it's legislation that I am supporting. What we are seeing is not only some Republicans in the Senate coming on board, we are seeing some conservative leaders of the regional Fed. For example, the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank, Richard Fisher, wrote in 2011, and he said, "The safer the individual banks, the safer the financial system. The ultimate destination, an economy relatively free from financial crises, won't be reached until we have the fortitude to break up the giant banks," end of quote. That is a conservative president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. And we've heard other conservatives make that point. And the other point that they make is if you are a huge financial institution, implicitly having the guarantee that no matter how bad the situation is, the Congress is going to bail you out, you can attract capital at a significantly lower rate than your competition, say a small community bank. So you're giving the too-big-to-fail banks a major financial advantage over other financial institutions, and that's one. But bottom line is we need more competition in the financial marketplace, and we've got to break these babies up.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie. A few days early here today, the madness of all of our schedules. So we'll be taking your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for the Bernie Buzz. Find out what's going on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And by the way, one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How We Can Fight Back, courtesy of Stamps.com. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Not a chance. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It is. We are live on Tuesday. I just got back from Germany. I'm about to head out to Vegas here. But we're doing the program live today. So you are not hearing a repeat. Senator Sanders is with us live. It works for my schedule. It works for his schedule to make this our Brunch with Bernie Day. So, and the lines are slammed. So, Bernie, shall we pick up some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, and I'll take them off the air. One is, I thought it was against the law to add to the national debt through Social Security. And my second question is, I do work for the post office. What's going on? And I will take your question off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay. Linda, thanks for the call. Let's start off with the post office. We are working very hard on this issue. I'm not on the relevant committee, but I've brought together a number of senators who believe that we should not be decimating the postal service or developing a death spiral by cutting, cutting, and cutting. To answer your question, I think things are still in limbo. I know that the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, Tom Carper, who has jurisdiction over this issue, has been talking with colleagues in the House. The immediate issue, by the way, Linda, that is surfacing is the question of Saturday mail delivery. The Postmaster General has for a while wanted to cut Saturday mail delivery, but in the continuing resolution passed in the House, passed in the Senate, and signed by the President, the language was very clear that Saturday mail delivery continues. The essence of the debate is the Postmaster General thinks that it is the best interest of the Postal Service to cut, cut, cut. Cut post offices, cut delivery centers, cut Saturday mail. Some of us believe that the best future for the post office is to make it a 21st century institution to deal with the major financial problem, and that is the onerous burden that the post office now has in terms of retiree health, future retiree health benefits, which is in fact causing 75% to 80% of the financial problems of the Postal Service. If we end that onerous burden and we give the Postal Service, in my view, the flexibility and the freedom to bring in new revenue, you can solve the Postal Service problems without making massive cuts.
And the other question was?
Oh, the national debt and Social Security. Here's the issue. There's a lot of confusion out there. Social Security today, and this is what the Social Security Administration tells us, has a $2.7 trillion surplus. Now, some people think, well, we should lock that in a box. No, you should not. What you should do with that money is invest it in Treasury bonds so that you earn interest. And one of the ways the Social Security trust fund makes money is by interest on their investment in Treasury bonds. Bottom line is, in terms of Social Security, $2.7 trillion surplus can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 20 years. And with modest fixes, such as removing the cap, as we talked about a moment ago, we will be strong for 50 years. It is not necessary to cut Social Security benefits. The American people don't believe we should do that. It has nothing to do with deficit reduction because Social Security is funded by the payroll tax. And we're going to work as hard as we can to prevent those cuts.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching on Dish Network on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom and Senator? I want to thank you for representing the American people instead of just the special interests. In regards to Social Security, I want to point out that the Republicans are the ones that are demanding cuts to Social Security and Medicare, not the Democrats, only they call it entitlement reform. And, you know, I think that maybe the president is just, he's not really saying he wants to agree to the chain CPI. What he's saying is, I may agree to some sort of chain CPI if you Republicans will raise taxes on billionaires. And they've already said they will absolutely not do that. So he's really not offering anything. It's kind of like me saying, I'll give you $1 million if you fly to Mars with no rocket ship. I'm not really offering you $1 million, you know?
Well, Paul, I don't look at it quite that way. I think what you have characterized is correct. But I look at it in another way. in the sense that while you're right in saying that there may end up not being any deal, that there may not be cuts in Social Security because the Republicans refused to raise taxes on the wealthy. I think that's a correct assertion. But on the other hand, the president has voluntarily come forward and said, I am prepared to make rather significant cuts, not only in Social Security, but in benefits for disabled veterans. I think that is wrong. When you're negotiating, it is always important to understand who you have behind you and who they have behind them. If the country is divided 50-50 on an issue, well, you know, you got to go into negotiations and say, you know what, I've got half the American people against me. You know, I can't expect to get everything. It's going to have to be a 50-50 deal. On this issue of whether or not we should cut Social Security, as opposed to asking large corporations and the wealthy to start paying their fair share of taxes, we've got 75 or 80% of the American people behind us. It is the Republicans who are in a very, very difficult negotiating position. And what the president has got to do is make them a deal, an offer they can't refuse. And that is, if they are only interested in cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and giving tax breaks to the rich, we're going to beat them politically. And the American people are going to say, if you want to come back to Washington, you better change your tune.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour Tuesday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your calls for Senator Sanders coming up right after this, 27 minutes past the hour. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yes, it's a live Brunch with Bernie here on Tuesday, here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more with Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Tuesday, the 9th of April. And we are live with Senator Bernie Sanders and our Brunch with Bernie hour a little early this week, or a little late from last week, or both. And Edward in Clearwater, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm a disabled veteran, and my question is regarding Social Security benefits. Good afternoon.
Edward, you need to turn your TV down. It'll hopelessly confuse you because there's a delay. Get right to your question for Bernie, he'll answer it.
Yes, I'm a disabled veteran. Wanted to know what is going on with Social Security, because I also received Social Security benefits, as far as them cutting it, and what can I do to prevent some of this from happening? I know that Obama's doing this basically to try to appease the Republicans with something, but if he's going for that as well, I didn't vote for him to do that.
No, that's right, Edward. You didn't, and millions of other people didn't, and that's why virtually every grassroots progressive organization is up in arms against the president's initiative. Here's what it would do. It would make substantial cuts to VA benefits of some 3.2 million veterans. That's a whole lot of folks out there. Veterans who started receiving their disability benefits at age 30 would have their benefits reduced by $1,400 a year at age 45, $2,300 a year at age 55, and $3,200 a year at age 65. Also, spouses, widows of men who died in Iraq or Afghanistan would also see their benefits cut as well. What can you do about it? Get on the phone right now and call up your senators, your members of the House, and tell them that you do not believe that it is appropriate to cut benefits for people who have put their lives on the line defending our country and have often suffered some grievous wounds. That's not what America is about. There are better ways to do deficit reduction than on the backs of disabled vets. So that is the story. We've got to work hard to defeat that. And I think if the American people stand up with some of us here in the Congress, we can defeat it.
And here's how crazy it's getting, Bernie. Just FYI, this over at Democratic Underground from 99 Forever, a resident of Wisconsin who says, I just called my congressional representative to ask her for her position on the chain CPI. Her staffer said, quote, Representative Michelle Bachmann opposes the cuts to Social Security and Medicare proposed by President Barack Obama and will fight to see that they don't happen. It's like we've stepped through the mirror, you know?
Well, but here's the interesting thing. That's Minnesota, I suppose.
Wisconsin, yeah. Or Minnesota, whatever.
Well, she's from Minnesota.
Bachmann is, yeah.
But here's the point. From a political point of view, that is exactly what the Republicans will do. So where the Democrats are going after the Ryan budget, appropriately, it is a disastrous budget. End Medicare as we know it. Devastating cuts in Medicaid, education, nutrition, heating programs, you name it. But the Republicans will say, well, yeah, that's a bad budget. But look what the president and the Democrats are talking about. They want to cut Social Security and veterans programs. And the average American will say a plague on both of your houses.
Yeah.
And cynicism will grow even worse than it is right now.
Ed, in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, watching us on live stream. Hey, Ed, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, how's it going, Senator?
Great.
The reason I call is that I can't take any money off of my taxes when I contribute to a political campaign. But a corporation could fly somebody around, take the money off for lobbyists, the whole nine yards. What's the deal? Are corporations more of a person than I am?
Yeah, I guess maybe they are. As I think you know, the Supreme Court a couple of years ago issued a beyond belief absurd ruling telling us that through Citizens United decision that corporations are people in terms of political contributions. And the bottom line is they can now contribute as much money as they want, often in secret, to political campaigns. I think, you know, we have introduced and other people have introduced constitutional amendments to overturn Citizens United. It is a decision which undermines the very fabric of American democracy. What most of us were educated to believe is that America is about one person, one vote. You and I disagree, that's fine. You get a vote. I get a vote. But now what the Supreme Court has said is, yeah, I get a vote, you get a vote, but billionaires and large corporations can contribute as much as they want to a political, to the political campaigns, and that is an absolute disaster. Citizens United has got to be overturned.
Wayne in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Yes, Senator, there's a question I've been wanting to ask you for a while. The Republicans had offered the president to take the sequester legislation out of the bill two times. Now, he insisted that that sequestration legislation stay in the bill. And things are happening now, like as we speak, there are cancer patients who are in imminent danger of not receiving continued care. So what I want to know is, what is the political thinking behind Obama backing the sequester when it's self-destructive for the country?
Okay. Wayne, good question, but here are the facts. I don't think anybody is backing sequestration. Sequestration, I think almost everybody agrees, is a terrible, terrible way to do deficit reduction because it excludes some entities, some agencies like the Veterans Administration, but basically it is across-the-board cuts, which is not the way you should do deficit reduction. And it is causing, as you've indicated, serious problems. Sequestration is not something the president wanted or I wanted or anybody else wanted. The problem that we faced is our Republican friends want to do deficit reduction without adding one nickel new revenue, despite the fact that revenue today as a percentage of GDP is the lowest that it has been in 60 years, and one out of four major corporations pays nothing in taxes. So they want to go forward with what you're looking at is bad and worse. Sequestration is bad. Something like the Ryan budget, which includes no new revenue, but devastating cuts, ending Medicare as we know it, converting it into a voucher program, massive cuts in Medicaid education and every program that working people depend upon. So that's what the debate is about. What you have under sequestration is that half of the cuts take place within the Defense Department and half of the cuts take place in non-defense discretionary spending, some of which, as you've indicated, are very, very painful. So I voted against the legislation to bring forth the sequestration bill, but the choices are not that anyone wants sequestration, but what our Republican friends want is something even worse.
Brian in Denver, Colorado. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Great. I guess my question is just this. I used to feel like there's not much we could do, and we didn't have the answers basically to all of our problems. But now I'm feeling like we're coming together as a people through different media, internet type of places, and coming up with some real real solutions to the problems that we have. But I don't know what my question would be, what else can we do along with, like Tom said at the top of the program, calling our congressmen and President Obama and holding rallies at the White House? How do we get the ear of the people in power, the Congress the President, when they're not doing the will of the people? We elected
them. Good, Brian, you got it. All right. Brian, you've asked a very good question. And I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head with that question. And I think the answer is going to be we do anything and everything that our political imagination allows us to do. I mean, the easy stuff is the writing the letter to the editor, having the courage to put your name down on a position. You'd be surprised, Brian, how many people are just afraid of that. I believe this, but I don't really want to put my name down on a letter to the editor. You can, of course, call up your senators, your members of the House, the White House hotline, and voice your opinion there. But you can also be a lot more creative than that. You can work with your friends in the organizations that you are a member of and contact your member of the House or Senate and say, I would like to see you do a town meeting in my community to discuss some of the important issues, Social Security, or whatever it may be. Become aggressive. Reach out. Make demands on your political leaders. And if they choose not to show up, you've learned something important.
45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie Tuesday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a moment. Don't forget, Bernie has a website, sanders.senate.gov, which aggregates the news of the day, and his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz. Sign up for it there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room here at tomhartman.com. It's free, it's fun, and it's got some of the finest minds on earth hanging out. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie on Tuesday here program. And Bill in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk, AM 950. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi there. The Republican majority in the House is a gerrymandered majority. Why can't Democrats constantly and uniformly refer to the gerrymandered House majority or the Republican gerrymandered House majority? So I hear that thousands of times, like I've heard tax and spend liberal thousands of times.
Well, I think, Bill, you make a good point. Gerrymandering is not a new concept. In fact, it's named after a guy who was alive, when was it, Tom, during the Revolutionary War?
Shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, so the concept of gerrymandering is something that's been done by both parties. But your point is right. I think the Republicans have taken it to an entirely new level. And, in fact, surprisingly enough, people will be surprised to know that Democrats got more votes in House races last election than Republicans did. And I think the American people need to know that. So I think, Bill, your point is a good one.
Doug, listening on AM 760 in Denver, Colorado. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hey, major props to you two guys, huh?
Thanks.
Hey, Bernie, of all the places to get some good history on our nation, on Saturday mornings on CBS is an hour cartoon called Liberty's Kids. And right now they're in the process of educating people on the post office, which prompts me to ask you the question. If that's so-called protected in the Constitution, should it not take a two-thirds majority vote to amend the Constitution, or am I way off base?
Well, I don't think you're. It is protected. It is mentioned in the Constitution for all kinds of good reason. Universal mail service, getting information, being able to communicate with your neighbors and people is a fairly basic right. What is not mentioned in the Constitution, of course, is the nature of the Postal Service. But the bottom line here is, I believe very strongly that in the middle of a terrible recession, you don't want to shrink hundreds of thousands of jobs. You don't want to cause hundreds of thousands of people to be unemployed. That's number one. Number two, what I believe is that the Postal Service plays an enormously important role, especially in rural areas, above and beyond just delivering mail. It becomes a meeting place for people in rural America. And number three, what we all have to understand is the major financial problem facing the Postal Service is this unbelievably onerous condition placed on the Postal Service in the 2006 Congressional Act, which mandates that they fund 75 years of retiree health benefits in a 10-year period over $5 billion a year. That causes 75 to 80% of the Postal Service problems today. Furthermore, the Postal Service by law is restricted about how they can raise revenue. They can't even do simple things like notarizing letters or make copies when you walk into a Postal Service or cash non-government checks. There are a whole lot of ways that Postal Services around the world are making revenue, protecting jobs, serving customers that we should be looking at as we fight to protect the U.S. Postal System.
Tom in Downers Grove, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Loud and clear.
Okay. Quick question and a comment. Senator Sanders, big fan. Why, and Tom, you may, I don't know if you've ever had him on your show, is Senator Reid. Why, when the new Senate came in, did they not change the filibuster rules? Because right now, with the way that Alex, since 1980, has gone after state legislatures to set up gerrymandering, we now have a minority with the majority in Congress, and you know what's going on there. And with the Senate, why in the world did he change the rules because we elected more Democrats to the Senate?
Well, Tom, I think you're asking a very fair question. I voted against the agreement that was reached. I think I was the only person in the Democratic caucus to do so, precisely because we really did not institute real filibuster reform. And the essence of filibuster reform is pretty simple. If somebody wants to get on the floor, and Senator Paul did a month ago or so, and you want to speak for 10 hours or 20 hours, you have the right to do that. There should be as much debate as members of the Senate want. That's what the Senate is about. But at the end of that debate, we should have a vote, and 51 votes should win that debate, not 60 votes. And so long as we continue to need 60 votes, the minority has far more power than a minority should have. I believe in protecting minority rights, but the minority should not be able to control what the majority wants, and to a large degree, that's what we have right now. So I am a strong supporter of filibuster reform, and I will continue to fight for that.
Yeah. And in that, you're the strict constitutionalist, because the Constitution says a majority wins in the House and Senate, with
right.
the exceptions.
What you're dealing with here is nothing constitutional. These are rules of the Senate. They used to be two-thirds. Now they're 60.
Right.
We should get it down to 51.
All right. Bernie, we have just 60 seconds before the end of the hour here. Not enough for a call. Your thoughts on the week and what's coming up and what we should be doing and looking for and thinking about?
Well, these are extremely busy times in Congress and important times for the American people. And the issue is whether the Congress listens to the vast majority of Americans, middle class, working class, lower income people who are hurting financially, and whether or not the Congress has the courage to stand up to the big money interest and all of their lobbyists and say, wait a second, if we're going to do deficit reduction, you guys who are making huge profits, you folks who are doing phenomenally well, you're going to have to help us with deficit reduction, and we're not going to cut Social Security or vet benefits for disabled vets or Medicare or programs that working families desperately depend on. That is exactly the moment that we're in right now, and all of us have got to get into this fight and win this struggle for social justice.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks again for being with us this week, Senator.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Always a pleasure having you on. See you next week. Senator Bernie Sanders, be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov and sign up for his newsletter, The Bernie Buzz. We'll be back. Peter Ferrara is going to be with us an hour from now. John Brown is going to be up next, former member of parliament during Maggie Thatcher's reign.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Maggie Thatcher has left this earth. And boy, is there a wide variety of opinion about that, about her, her tenure as Prime Minister of Great Britain. Not unlike the many thoughts and comments about Ronald Reagan. So I wanted to get on somebody who might have a little more intimate view of her than most of the rest of us. John Brown is with us. He's a former member of Parliament during Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's tenure. He is the senior market strategist at Euro-Pacific Capital. The website there is Europac, EUROPAC.net. And MP Brown, or former MP Brown, I'm not sure quite how to address you. John Brown?
Welcome. Yes, that's right, Tom. Good afternoon.
Welcome to the program. I'm curious what the, in general, first of all, your opinion of Margaret Thatcher's tenure as PM and what you think the average Brit thinks of her.
The last part was, what do I think the average what?
The average British citizen thinks of her.
Oh, okay. Well, the last part is more difficult, so I'll leave it to the end. My own view is, well, first of all, I was a member of Parliament for the whole time, plus a few years, and I have to say I found it the most exciting and invigorating thing I could have imagined. I mean, Parliament and Congress and all that thing are pretty exciting for their members, but this was just outstanding. We started with an absolute wrecked ship, and it sailed in the end as a very proud and successful ship. And there were really the reasons for it were, like President Reagan, Margaret Thatcher delivered. Most politicians sort of talk the talk, but these two people walked the walk. And I believe it was because they both operated from fundamental principles and core beliefs that they held very strongly in their hearts, and they were prepared to exercise them. And Margaret Thatcher, and I also believe Ronald Reagan, their core beliefs could be summed up in a single word that many millions of people have fought and died for. It was the heart of Magna Carta and the basis of the Declaration of Independence, and that single word was freedom. Freedom from outside aggression, like the Falkland Islands of Margaret Thatcher. Freedom from oppressive taxation. Freedom from the abuse of trades union monopoly, like King Scargill of the miners. And freedom from excessive and repressive regulation. And this freedom that England suddenly enjoyed resulted in a huge blossoming of enterprise. I mean, we had a debt repayment schedule. I mean, it was quite unheard of. People thought we were going to go on into ever-increasing debts, and we started paying it back.
Well, she raised taxes from 33% of GDP when she came in to 38% of GDP by 1984. It was at 35% of GDP when she left. Here in the United States, taxes are 19% of GDP. Ronald Reagan raised taxes 18 times.
It was an amazing thing to have any repayment. Yeah. And of course, she did it by privatizing industries, coal, steel, all this sort of railways, all these things that are grinding to a halt. And also, of course, very importantly, because the financial sector is very important in the British economy, she had Big Bang in the City of London. No longer were we charging 0.25% on a long bond. Suddenly it was open to competitive bidding for the commissions. And in order to deliver these incredible targets and out of her belief, it requires very strong belief, great courage, and a preparedness for self-sacrifice. And today, I'm afraid our leaders, we don't have leaders, we have managers who are careerists. I don't think either Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan were in for a career. They were just in for their country. They wanted power to see that they could do good for their country rather than a career. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, for example, her husband, who many people play down as a buffoon because he preferred to act rather that way to shield himself from political investigation all the time and asking what was Margaret doing. I used to play a lot of golf with him because we were the two worst players on the Lords and Commons team. He had a handicap of 18 and I had 17, and so we were always teamed together as Taylor and Charlie's. But he was an executive director of one of the largest oil companies in the world. You know, he was a professional businessman, really savvy, guarded Margaret Thatcher's back like a centurion, and was a tremendous advisor to her on a strategic basis. A huge help to Margaret Thatcher, and yet he sort of was painted by the world as a buffoon.
To what extent?
Margaret depended on him a lot, and that's why when he died, I think she really sank back a lot when Dennis died. But she was already out of Parliament, not voted out by the voter, not a democratic vote of the nation at all, but the treachery of the closest lieutenants to her.
Well, it was her own cabinet that kicked her out, was it not?
Oh, she was knifed down in a sea of political blood knee-deep by her cohorts like Jeffrey Howe, Michael Heseltine, Douglas Hurd, these people who wanted the job. They didn't want Britain to succeed, or they did, but as a secondary. Their real thing was out for power. And Margaret Thatcher's main aim was for Britain to be restored, like it's similar to Ronald Reagan, in my opinion.
Well, you know, I was here and watched Reagan. I noticed Thatcher, and I was certainly, you know, aware and an adult during the years that she was prime minister. But I can tell you, Ronald Reagan came in on a campaign, on a platform of reducing our debt, and instead, in 8 years, he borrowed more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined, including during all our wars, spent over a trillion of it to his cronies in the Star Wars industry, which still is a joke. So we had the joke at the time was, give me $1 trillion and I'll show you what it looks like to live large. It was the beginning of an enormous bubble.
I started the argument, but people, if they told it SDI or whether they called it Star Wars,
sure.
If it was Star Wars, they were against it.
Yeah.
But I was asked to be the escort to Mr. Gorbachev when he first came to the West.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with him for 3 days, him and Mrs. Gorbachev, and I formed the very rapid opinion that he was going to become the Soviet leader of the Soviet Union.
Right.
I was totally ridiculed in the press, the television, by our foreign secretary, everyone, except Margaret Thatcher, who sat forward when that night I first briefed her on our chair and said, what, you really think there's going to be change? You really think he's going to be the leader? She paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
The only other person who really paid attention was Ronald Reagan, President of Reagan.
Yeah.
And the fact is, and it was quite apparent at that time, that it was the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars as you call it, that brought the Russians to the negotiating table.
Okay. So quick question. Pardon me for interrupting you, but we just have a minute left. It's the tyranny of the clock here in commercial radio. What would you have David Cameron do differently, given your admiration for the legacy of
resign.
Resign. I mean, and be replaced by whom?
My way of thinking. He promised the British people a cast iron guarantee of a referendum as to whether they wanted to stay in the European superstate or not. He absolutely carted them by getting elected and refusing to grant what he had promised.
Mm-hmm.
Now he promises an even more Machiavellian and deceptive thing. He says, okay, if you vote for me again and I get in, I'll guarantee a referendum in 2014, knowing that on the 1st of January 1914, any referendum in Europe has to be approved by Brussels. so he knows they'll never get it.
Right.
I mean, this is utter deception.
So do you think the UK should become integrated with the EU and abandon the pound?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, like Switzerland, like Japan, like other nations, providing you've got the energy, the will to survive on your own and the ability, it doesn't matter that you're small, you can still be very effective in the world.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. Sir, forgive me, the clock has hit us, but thank you so much for being with us. Former member of the Parliament, and senior market strategist of Euro-Pacific Capital. Thank you very much, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I should say, Mr. John Brown, former MP. We'll be right back. So who was Maggie Thatcher? My sense of her always was that she was one of those people who comforted the comfortable and afflicted the afflicted. Much like Ronald Reagan. Morrissey, the singer of the 1980s band The Smiths, published an interesting piece today. He said Thatcher is remembered as the Iron Lady only because she can possess completely negative traits such as persistent stubbornness and a determined refusal to listen to others. Every move she made was charged by negativity. She destroyed the British manufacturing industry. Well, Reagan began that process to the American manufacturing industry. She hated the miners. Reagan busted up the unions. She hated the arts. Reagan defunded the arts. She hated the Irish freedom fighters and allowed them to die. Well, you could argue that they were throwing bombs at her. They almost killed her, in fact. There's a little more nuance to that story. She hated protection. She hated the English poor and did nothing to help them at all. She hated Greenpeace and environmental protectionists, Morrissey says. She was the only European political leader who opposed a ban on the ivory trade. Let us remember, she called Nelson Mandela a terrorist. She hated feminists. I just find it interesting. I've read a whole series of articles here this morning about Thatcher and Reagan and I did not know until just a few minutes ago that Margaret Thatcher's husband was a director of the largest oil company in England. That's a little bit like discovering that Ronald Reagan's wife was running Enron. It's really quite incredible, you know, when you think about it. Mark, in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Mark. Mark, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Your thoughts on
all this? Hi, Tom. It's great to hear you. I read some limits to growth work by Meadows and Rander. Danella Meadows was a systems analyst. But anyway, she related a story that the environmental scientists from the West met the environmental scientists from the East at Ballantyne on the Black Sea, and they were able to relate to her that change needed to happen and that Gorbachev could do this, and it got to Margaret Thatcher, and it got to Ronald Reagan. So it's an interesting tale, if that's really true, and I don't have a way to follow up on it, but Limits to Growth and Beyond the Limits is an interesting side trip on
that. Well, that was about the time the Club of Rome was first meeting.
Ending was really environmental scientists saying, we got to stop this.
Yeah, and that was when the Club of Rome came out with their famous report. I don't for a minute believe that either Margaret Thatcher or Mikhail Gorbachev came to any sort of rapprochement with Ronald Reagan as a result of Star Wars, because Star Wars didn't work. There was no there other than the transfer of over $1 trillion to capitalist cronies of the Reagan administration. What I do know, and this is a matter of public record, is that back in the mid-60s and throughout the 1970s, there were repeated statements from the Central Intelligence Agency, from international intelligence groups, that the Soviet Union was falling apart. I was there. I saw it. I was in East Berlin. I saw it. I was in Western Russia. I saw it. I was in Moscow. I saw it. The Soviet Union was falling apart. And, Marx's analysis of capitalism, I think, in Das Kapital was right. I think his prescription for what to do about it, as put forward by him and Engels in a Communist Manifesto, didn't quite work out the way they hoped. And it was going down in flames, and Gorbachev was the guy who made the transition. But that's just my personal opinion. But I don't think it was SDI. I think it was the inevitability of bad economic policies. Just like I think now we are facing incredible economic difficulties in the United States, and the UK is as well, as a consequence of Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics, both of them borrowing and spending. I mean, you look at the borrowing and spending that Margaret Thatcher did, and it's, you know, during her time as prime minister, it was really quite extraordinary. I mean, 1979, her first year, her first full year in office, she spent 42% of GDP government spending. Now, keep in mind, our government spending as a percentage of GDP is around 21% right now. She spent 42% of government GDP, but taxes only collected 33.5%. The next year, spending went up to 45%, taxes only to 35%. The next year, spending went up to 46%. This is 81, 82. Taxes only at 38%. Now, they were high. She had raised taxes from 33 to 38%, but she had increased spending from 42 to 46%. So, you know, if you want to talk about Reagan and Thatcher both bankrupting their nation, that would be my opinion. But again, I was not there. Our guest a few minutes ago was. On the other hand, his perspective was probably quite different than that of the coal miners and the people in the streets and the average person who saw their benefits being cut and or the social net, safety net being cut out from underneath them. But I don't know, and I can't, and he's not here to defend himself. I'm not going to speak to that or about that. Marilyn in Portland. Marilyn, we have a minute to the break.
Hi,
what's
there
up?
Tom, yeah, I think it's a new discovery for me that Margaret Thatcher's husband was an oil man.
Yeah.
And, of course, we know that George Bush, Reagan's vice president, was also an oil man. And
yep.
I think we have an oligopoly. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I you know, Marilyn, I think you're right. And, you know, oil's pretty vital stuff economically. Shouldn't be. You know, we should have gotten past that. It's really a 19th century fuel, maybe early, arguably early 20th century. Pardon?
You watch this outrageous thing going on with XL Pipeline, and it is absolutely against everything that is good for America.
Yeah, and good for the world. Marilyn, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you live on this beautiful Tuesday. And boy, is it hot. It's 92.3 degrees here in the studio. They haven't turned the air conditioning on in the building yet. And it's going to be an interesting spring. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And by the way, the former chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission talking about all 104 nuclear plants should be phased out. Really? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very interlacustrinely ugly. The good. WikiLeaks. During a Monday event at the National Press Club, the news leaking organization announced the release of over 1.7 million U.S. State Department cables and memos from 1973 through 1976. According to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who spoke to the press club crowd via Skype from London, this newest trove of documents has been in the public domain for a decade, but has never been presented in a format usable for researchers. Assange also told the audience that WikiLeaks wanted to publicize the, quote, Kissinger cables, named after former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, because new classification policies could remove them from the public domain. Journalists hope to use the documents to shed light on some of the more controversial moments in American diplomatic history, like the CIA's support for Augusto Pinochet's 1973 overthrow of the Chilean government. Happy hunting, and good work, WikiLeaks. The bad, Mitch McConnell. On Monday, the Senate Minority Leader delayed an important vote to confirm Patty Schwartz as a judge on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals because he wanted to attend a basketball game. Although his presence was not technically necessary for confirmation, McConnell used his influence as the head Republican in the Senate to postpone the vote until Tuesday so he could watch the Louisville Cardinals win the NCAA title. Senator McConnell and his fellow Republicans have made a habit of blocking President Obama's judicial appointments, so this latest delay mechanism shouldn't be that surprising. However, when you consider the number of times the Senate Minority Leader has attacked Obama for playing golf or taking scheduled vacations, his trip to the NCAA championship just reeks of hypocrisy. And the very, very ugly Whitson's School Nutrition. When students lined up for lunch at Coelho Middle School in Attleboro, Massachusetts last Tuesday, they expected to dig into one of the meal provider Whitson's delicious meals. What they got instead was a lesson in corporate callousness. After on-site Whitson's representatives learned that some kids had received lunches without having enough money in their meal cards to pay for them, they ordered the students to immediately throw the meals into the trash. That's right, Whitson's workers forced middle schoolers to throw their lunches into the trash because they couldn't front the $2.40 needed to buy the meal. That is just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. That is mind-bogglingly ugly. I don't know what could be uglier, but that right up there. Okay. This is pretty amazing. Senator James Inhofe, he's talking, you know, the Newtown families, there's a bunch of, the Air Force One, the president gave a ride from Newtown to Washington, D.C. today for a number of the parents of these slaughtered children to come talk to individual members of Congress. And they showed up at James Inhofe's office, Senator, the Republican from Oklahoma. And the senator told reporters, this is from the Center for American Progress, this blog thing, Progress, told reporters that the coming debate will have nothing to do with the families of the victims from Newtown, Connecticut. Quote, "See, I think it's so unfair of the administration to hurt these families to make them think this has something to do with them when, in fact, it doesn't." End quote. Right. Debating gun laws has nothing to do with the Newtown families. Nothing whatsoever. It's really, you know, quite amazing. Quite amazing. Maggie Thatcher, may she rest in peace, although many of her victims probably did not, will not, particularly those in Argentina. I thought, you know, one of the most astounding things, and this was a precedent that she established that Ronald Reagan followed with his invasion of Grenada, and that I believe George Bush followed with his invasion of Iraq. In fact, Jimmy Carter was the only president not to have a war, even a little war, during his presidency, since, he was president during the last 2 years of the Thatcher, his last 2 years were the first 2 years of Thatcher's prime ministership. And, you know, in this dispute with the Falkland Islands, there was a Argentinian ship filled with, you know, young soldiers, and they were outside the exclusion zone that the British had drawn around the Falkland Islands, and they were leaving. They were sailing away from the Falkland Islands. And Maggie Thatcher ordered it bombed and them killed. And then when asked about it, she gave the thumbs up to the press, like, hey, great military victory. Which is by and large how, you know, Rupert Murdoch and the right-wing press spun it. Just like George Herbert Walker Bush, as the Iraqis were retreating from Kuwait, strafed the retreating, you know, from the air, slaughtered the retreating army. Sometimes you think, you know, this is just an amazing world we live in. And some of the things that people will do in the name of politics, just extraordinary. Again, thanks. I just want to tip the hat and thank Dr. Mike Newcomb again for filling in for me. And, you know, he will again for a day or so here at the end of the week. I've going out to speak at the National Lawyers Guild or the National Trial Lawyers Association conference. But last week, as you all know, every year at this time in early April, for a long, long time, Every year I've been on the air, I've taken a trip to Germany because this is the anniversary of the death of the founder of the Salem organization. SalemInternational.org is the website, or Salem Children's Village, or Salem Children's Trust. I think it's SalemChildrensVillage.org, HunterSchool.org will get you there. The programs that Louise and I started here in the United States in 1978. And on Sunday, there was a group of us from all over the world, people who are doing this volunteer work, relief work around the world, gathered at Herr Miller's gravesite. And I read a piece from a Bible that Ursula, Herr Miller's wife, who's still with us, brought along. And after I was done, I flipped the Bible open to the very front, and there it was, my inscription to Mr. Miller, you know, to my dear friend, and signed by me in 1978. So it's been a long time that I've been hanging out with these people. It's a good organization, really good organization. So if you want to learn more about it, SalemInternational.org or HunterSchool.org here in the United States. And I'm back. And I think I told this story yesterday on the air to Dr. Mike, if you were listening. I don't know if you were or not, but the Germans are, you know, first of all, they will not have the Chertoff X-ray porno scanners, period. No porno scanners, sorry. We're not going to do that. That's stupid. Secondly, I show up at airport security. I didn't have to take any liquids out of my bag or anything. I just, you know, put my bag through the X-ray machine you have forever. And there's a magnetometer, you know, those just things that you walk through, and if you've got any metal on your body, it goes, woo, you know, like that. And I said to the security person, I'm wearing a pair of shoes that I've had for years, actually. They were a gift from a friend of mine. And these shoes have a metal buckle on the top of them, you know, just a decorative metal buckle. And I'm pretty sure they must have a little piece of metal inside, too, because they're pretty well made. And I know that these shoes will set off a magnetometer. And so I said to the security person, let me take my shoes off and put them through the X-ray machine. And he was like, no, we don't do that here. You cowards in America, you do that, but we don't do that here. So I said, okay. And I walked through the magnetometer, and sure enough, it went beep. So then I had to go back around, and he was like, okay, you can take off your shoes now. We'll put them through the X-ray machine. And I sat there while they X-rayed my shoes. And then he was, okay, thank you very much. But it's just so funny. It's like a matter of national pride, you know? You Americans are frigging wimps, you know? You're all acting like cowards, and you're terrified, and you know, and I mean, talk about people who take security seriously. I mean, this is the Germans. I mean, for the year that I lived there, I spent part of that year living literally 150 feet from the East German border. I mean, these are people who know what war is. They saw their country decimated. They know what fascism is. They know what a tyrannical government is. They know what genuine war is. They know what a real threat is. And they know what real security is. And they are not engaging in security theater. They were, you know, so. And I have no problem with, you know, rational security. And, in fact, I think that our security systems here in the United States are frankly getting better, particularly now that we've decided to junk the Chertoff X-ray porno scanners. Poor Michael Chertoff, he's got to figure out another way to make a living. I understand he only made a couple $10-20 million selling these things to, you know, they'll probably show up someplace else. Now they're using these microwave machines, or milliwave, I guess it is, machines. But anyhow, my airport story from yesterday. It seems like it was yesterday. It was whenever it was when I got on the plane. I know that I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, our time, to get to the train, to get to the plane, because it was 6 hours on the train to get to the plane for the 9-hour flight. Anyway, I'm here. Back with your calls after this. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Daniel is going to see Karl Rove tonight? Oh, we've got to take that call. Stick around, Daniel. Welcome back, Occupying the Media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. You can give a goat and help a freed slave, and you'll receive a photo of your goat and the slave, in all probability taken by Ellen herself, because she goes over to Sudan several times a year. You were just there a few weeks ago.
And I'm hoping to go back in June, but cure my adopted son, who was a slave, might have another corneal transplant, so if that happens.
Does that mean he might be able to see? Because
well,
his story is worth telling, if you can just
So he was taken to slavery in the north when he was a little baby with his mother. His mother was probably killed. He was turned upside down, hot peppers rubbed in his eyes, a fire lit under him, lost his vision. My doctor says it's like putting acid in somebody's eyes. Now he's at Perkins School for the Blind.
Wow, and he's now a teenager.
He's now,
You brought him over to the United States.
Yeah. Ellen, I have new respect for American culture.
Ellen discovers motherhood.
not happily.
Yeah, okay.
So North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Jay Carney said today that North Korea telling people in the South to leave who are foreigners was unhelpful rhetoric to escalate tensions, and it will further isolate North Korea from the international community. And it does look like Foreign Policy magazine broke the story today that, in fact, in March, Clifford Hart from the State Department, he's a special envoy to the six-party talks, which doesn't exist anymore, and that he basically met with the North Koreans, a deputy ambassador, and nothing came of it. But, of course, we didn't hear anything about it till Foreign Policy broke that story today.
Now, the 15th of April is the birthday of Kim Il, whatever, Jung Sun, the founder, his grandfather. It's the grandfather's birthday. And traditionally, that's the day when there's a big hoopla and they fire bombs off and things. Do you think young crazy guy is getting ready to?
Well, you know, it's interesting because CNN just came up with this story literally as I was walking in here, so I haven't had time to check it out. But that say North Korea has completed preparations for test firing mobile ballistic missiles, and so we don't have any idea what they're going to be doing on that front. Today there were hearings in Congress, and some of the senators said that they don't believe that China is doing enough to stop them. Although China, you know, did not object to a UN Security Council resolution, Tom, that said that no luxury goods could be sold to or brought into North Korea.
Right, which has to have Kim Jong-un, the current dictator.
Crazy. What do they
thinking,
do without their diamonds and video games?
I know, and how can he entertain Dennis Rodman the next time he shows up? I
mean, right.
He's going to be in.
Exactly.
Yeah. No more caviar.
All right. Social Security cuts. Now, our friend Senator Bernie Sanders, along with two other members of Congress, today showed up at the White House with 2.3 million signatures. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but you have to understand that was gathered in less than a week of people who wanted and who are saying, hey, do not cut our Social Security. Today, Jay Carney said, well, the president's budget, which comes out tomorrow, is less than desirable or less than
perfect. Harry Reid came out and said, you know, the president has his budget, we have ours.
That's right.
Because the Senate passed one that does not have a chain CPI in it.
That's right. And the chain CPI, the best way to describe it, and I looked at various things on the Internet, I'm sure you have a very good and have been talking about it, I know, Tom. But in the old CPI, so if you bought your coffee at Starbucks and then you switched to homemade, that would go into the Consumer Price Index and they would figure that out. Now, if the coffee gets too expensive and you have to switch to orange juice, that would be in the change CPI. So if you get Social Security now, by the time you're 85 years old under the change CPI, you could lose as much as $1,100 a year.
Right. It's chained to behavior. So if your behavior used to be that you ate steak, now you're eating hamburger, then now they start paying you for a hamburger. If you stop eating hamburger, start eating chicken because it's cheaper, then they start paying you for the chicken. If you stop eating chicken and start eating cat food, they pay you for the cat food, and thus the Cat Food Commission 2.0.
Okay, so it looks like the filibuster on guns may go bye-bye. It doesn't look like it has quite the filibuster group that it had this morning.
Really?
At 14 people. And Harry Reid said today that he's going to file the cloture. That's the 60 votes necessary to get this to the floor. Even Lindsey Graham, not usually a friend of the Democrats or anything else, he said, I want to proceed to this bill. I want to debate it. I'm not afraid of this bill.
Wow. On the other hand, Inhofe said, just came out and said, you know, having these Newtown parents here is silly because this has nothing to do with them.
Well, there is actually something they want to add to the gun bill, and that is the vets who are on Capitol Hill today. There is a bipartisan bill called Excellent in Mental Health. It's a bipartisan bill. Apparently, there's 22 veterans per day that commit suicide. It's a huge amount, and what they want to do is have parity, but it will probably be attached to the gun bill.
Right.
As an amendment.
Huh.
Very hard for, I think, senators to vote that down.
Yeah.
But you never know.
And when it gets to the House?
Well,
toast.
Like everything else. Yeah. And we ought to get a big giant toaster and put it up in front of the House. Okay. The president today nominated two Republicans to the National Labor Relations Board. Now, it's interesting because Richard Trumka from the AFL-CIO sent out a notice or sent out a press release saying, look, these are not the people that we necessarily would have wanted, but they have got to get the National Labor Relations Board moving ahead. And so if this is what it will take to get a vote, then we are for it.
Well, after that circuit court ruling that those were recess appointments were illegal, it's not legally functioning, is it?
No, it's not functioning at all. So that's why Trumka said these are not our choices, but it will get things moving.
Right. Okay.
So
step by step. But it still has to get through the Senate, doesn't it?
Well, it has to get through the Senate. It's an advise and consent. But with two Republicans, how do you not move ahead? I mean, I guess you could.
Yeah.
And you could just say, there will be no
Hagel
labor relations, right?
Hagel was a Republican.
Right. I mean, Hagel was a Republican.
They wanted to take him down, too.
Right. I mean,
anything that might help Obama. That has been their mantra. It doesn't matter if it's good policy.
And anything that will help them in 2016.
Yeah. And 14.
And 2014, yes. Well, we have to get through 14 first.
Quick last story. We just hit the break.
Okay. Just Wired Magazine came out with a story today very quickly that the FBI has been trying to reprogram people's little fly cards so that they can track people. A lot of people say that's an illegal invasion of privacy.
Very interesting. Flying on airplanes?
No, those little cards that you use that you put in your computer that allow you to connect with the Internet anywhere.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and back in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon resigned in disgrace, Gerry Ford pardoned everybody and just thought he'd get it all behind him. The Republican Party was going down in flames. I remember my father, who was very active with the Republicans. He was very concerned that this might even go the way of the Whigs, in other words, vanish as a party, that Nixon had done such terrible damage. And Jude Winiski came up with this theory, which he suggested, you know, the Democrats had always been Santa Claus. They were the Santa Claus of Social Security, of unemployment benefits, of workplace safety rules, of child labor laws, of food safety laws, of pure drug laws, of weekends, you know, overtime, if you have to work over the weekends, a 40-hour work week, minimum wage, all these things. And in every single case, the Republicans had said, no, we don't like that. They had been the Scrooges. So Jude Winiski said, we need to become Santa Claus, Republicans, and we need to force the Democrats to eventually shoot their own Santa Claus. And his proposal was to become the tax cut Santa Claus. The average working person wouldn't realize that really when the Republicans passed tax cuts, it was just, you know, pennies for the average working person. It was hundreds of billions of dollars for the big shots. But, you know, but still, hey, a tax cut's a tax cut. We'd become the tax cut Santa Clauses. And the way that you force the Democrats to shoot their Santa Claus is by cutting taxes, cutting revenue to the government, and spending like drunken sailors when in office. Ronald Reagan tripling the national debt, George Herbert Walker Bush adding another trillion to it, George W. Bush, spending another $4 or $5 trillion. We'll see what it all adds up to when the cost of the wars are done. It might be closer to 10. And when the country is running out of money and the Republicans will not raise taxes, then you must force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus. And now President Obama has, for the first time, first Democratic president since 1935. Well, the first Democratic president in history to say, yes, I am willing to shoot Santa Claus. I am willing to cut Social Security via the mechanism of the chain CPI. And Peter Ferrara is with us. He is a fellow at the Carlson Center for Public Policy, website theccpp.org. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Always nice to hear your voice. You were in the Reagan White House. Republicans have to be turning cartwheels right now.
Well, I'm opposed to these Social Security benefit cuts. That's very silly policy.
Michelle Bachmann has said the same thing. I mean, this is exactly what a Republican should say as soon as a Democrat says, I'm going to shoot Santa Claus, is, what?
Well, intelligent retirement reform would enable us to have pay actually better benefits to the poor and to seniors while reducing cost to taxpayers dramatically, all through proven reforms that have already worked in the real world, such as the 1996 welfare reform or the personal accounts for Social Security that were adopted in Chile 30 years ago.
You mean imposed by the dictator and then rejected by the people?
No, they were embraced by it. It was individual choice. It was a vote by the people. They made their individual choice.
Mr. Pinochet was not giving people votes, Peter. Mr. Pinochet was killing people.
Personal accounts. And so the working people embraced it.
So net, we can argue about whether that's the fact or not. Let's assume for the purpose of discussion that everything you've said is absolutely accurate. Are you suggesting then that we should be privatizing Social Security?
Yes, we should have the same freedom of choice for American workers. Why should you impose your opinion on whether that's a good deal on every worker in the country? Let you make your argument, I'll make my argument, and then let each worker decide for himself or herself. That's a principle of freedom rather than.
What about those workers who don't make enough money that they can set aside enough that when retirement time comes they'll have enough to live on?
They're
Screw
already
them.
Paying Social Security taxes. So under the proposal, they would be free to take use part or all of that eventually to finance a personal savings and investment insurance account that will pay them higher benefits in the future. At the same time, it will dramatically reduce.
But what if they're unemployed?
Spending.
To hell with them.
What about what?
What if they're unemployed?
If they're unemployed, Social Security doesn't give them any benefits. Unemployment.
No, but it does when they retire.
Pretty benefits while they're unemployed.
It does when they
retire.
They're
unemployed, they still have a personal account, and so. But when
it's just no money goes into it.
Yeah, no money goes into Social Security either. So you get a zero for that year if you're unemployed all year.
Right, but you do get it even if you never earned anything or earned very little throughout your life. I mean, you know, my mother was a housewife her whole life. She got Social Security when she hit 65.
Yes, well, through a lifetime of savings and investment, you will always get higher benefits and income through a lifetime of no savings and investment. And I've done numerous studies over, you know, since the early 1980s to demonstrate that.
Okay, so back to my original question. Now that the president is...
some levels warrant better benefits through these...
Now that the president is saying that he is going to be the first Democrat in history, the first Democratic president in history to propose cuts to Social Security... your response as a Republican is, I'm surprised, is not to say, you know, congratulations, good on him, but rather to say that's not enough. We want to totally privatize the whole thing.
I've always been against that kind of cut. I don't know why he was so silly to embrace that. I've argued against those cuts. Why cut benefits when you can give working people a better deal by giving them the freedom to make choice?
By privatizing.
Save and invest in a
right. We should just turn it all over to Goldman Sachs.
Is what?
Just turn it over to Goldman Sachs. Let them make our investment.
Worker gets to choose who makes the investment.
Well, yeah, you could choose between Goldman Sachs or.
That's
or,
called freedom. You let workers make the choice. You don't make the choice for everybody, which is what you always want to do. You don't want to let people make the choice. You know more than everybody, so you want to make the decision for everybody. That's
now, actually, Peter, there is a lot of areas where I don't want to make a choice. If I go into the doctor's office and the doctor says, you know, you got this lump here, and I think you ought to do X, Y, or Z. I don't want to sit around and say, you know, I think I'll make the choice on this.
Well, so you don't want to let patients have the freedom of choice as to whether to follow a doctor's advice.
No, what I'm saying is that there are some areas of my life where if things are set up so that I don't have to worry about it, I don't have to think about it, I don't have to make choices about it, all I have to know is that when I turn 65, I'm going to have enough income that I don't live in poverty. That's fine with me. And I think that's true of most Americans.
Well, it may not be fine with everybody, though. Other people may say, well, I don't think that you can rely on that promise.
Well, then save some extra money.
It's already proposing, even the most left-wing president in history is already proposing Social Security benefit cuts. So they may say, well, gee, that's not really reliable. And they may say, I think I can get a far better deal. And when that choice was given to working people in the South American right. nation of Chile, 95% of people did not choose your choice. They chose my choice.
So once again, your suggestion is now that Obama has or is about to, it'll happen tomorrow, propose to cut Social Security benefits. That's proof. You said, you know, now that a left-wing president has done it, that's proof of the wisdom of it.
That's proof that it's unreliable and people should choose a better deal through personal savings, best insurance accounts where they control the money themselves. The biggest tax most people pay is, in fact, the payroll tax. Wouldn't it be far better for working people? If they could save and invest that over a lifetime, have that compound those returns, that would do more to average out, to equalize.
What are you going to do, Peter, for the one-third of Social Security recipients who are not over 65 but instead are receiving Social Security because they fell and broke their necks and they're paralyzed?
Because, well, along with these personal accounts, you get survivor's insurance to provide survivor's midlife insurance to provide survivor's benefits, disability insurance.
How's that funded?
Disability benefits. That's what they do in Chile. That's what they do in Texas for local government workers in and around Galveston, Texas.
How is
and
that funded?
Like in Chile, they're getting much better benefits for much less in payments.
How is that funded? By
it's
taxes?
Funded by part of what they would otherwise pay in payroll tax.
Yeah. So you're still in favor of taxes and payroll tax?
I want to see workers have savings and investment rather than payroll taxes, paying payroll taxes to the government.
So you're not in favor of payroll
tax? Payroll tax entirely and give working people control over that money and let them participate in the capital system just like the capitalists.
Okay. So we can all be capitalists.
That's right.
Peter Ferrara, theCCPP.org. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. Bye-bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's amazing. It's amazing. When the president says, okay, here's what we're going to do, all the Republicans are going to come out and say, see? Brilliant idea. Going to listen to me? Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Daniel in Greenfield, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Daniel, thank you for your patience. What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, how are you?
Just fine.
I'm going to go see Karl Rove himself tonight. He's speaking at UMass Amherst on campus at 8 o'clock this evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, trying to think of what to ask him. And I asked Representative Jim McGovern the other day, and he had some thoughts. And you know, I had some thoughts about asking, you know, Karl Rove about Mike Connell and the death of Mike Connell as a cover up for the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio. But I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts were. You know, what would be a really good question, either a high road question or one that's not necessarily, or one that just has some, you know, fun at his expense.
Yeah. Well, the Mike Connell question, he would probably fairly easily dismiss you as a tinfoil hat theorist because most of the people in the room will not know that name. The Don Siegelman's son comes to mind. Don Siegelman is sitting in prison right now. Free-Don is the way, don.org is the website. And .com. And Don Siegelman is in prison because Karl Rove's best friend, you know, basically put him there, and his wife. And so it might be interesting to say something like, do you think that you will ever be held to legal account for the illegal role you played in the prosecution of Don Siegelman, of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman? Or, you know, words to that effect. Again, I'm sure he'll just brush it off and say, you know, I don't know what you're talking about.
I had some thought of saying that, you know, it would be wonderful for, you know, Democrats and Republicans to work together. But before we can really do that, it might be good to have both parties apologize for each of our wrongdoings. And, and that it would be really wonderful if you could admit to the killing or your part in the killing of Mike Connell and how that was a cover up of the theft of the 2004 election. And once these apologies are out of the way, the reconciliation can begin. You know, and then we can really begin to work with each other, you know, for a brighter future in America. And,
you know, a more general way of asking that same thing without bringing Mike McConnell into it might be to say, do you think that, like Nelson Mandela had in South Africa, that we should have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where people like yourself and the others who were involved in the Bush administration line us into two unnecessary wars and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people can be forgiven based on a confession.
Interesting.
And that's something everybody in the room would get.
Okay, so Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Okay.
So that's just, you know, a thought. Maybe one of our callers will have a better suggestion. So
okay.
You know, keep listening, Daniel. We've got a little more than a half hour left, and if anybody pops in with a good suggestion, I'll be sure and put them on the air, okay?
Okay, great. Yeah,
all
thank
right.
you so much, Tom.
Good luck. Thank you, Daniel. Time. Thanks for listening to WHMP.
So
yep. Scott in Belvedere, Illinois, listening to WCPTA. Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Nice to hear from you guys. But I'm just calling about that guy that's talking about Social Security and privatizing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anybody up in age that would want to do that just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, look what happened, what was it, 2007 or 2008, when everybody, you know, the stock market just fell on, you know, just fell.
Anybody of any age, it makes no sense.
Well, that's true, too. You know, I mean, sometimes you can't recover. And the thing of it is you need something for certain. And Social Security is, you know, the way it is right now, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I don't care what all these bumper stickers say and all this privatization. It makes no sense, you know?
Yeah. And it always has.
You need to have something. For sure, it's there all the time. Like Bernie Sanders says, the checks come through all the time.
Yeah, yeah,
and
checks have
you
never
can't
bounced.
Gamble.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, Scott. I'm totally with you. And privatization would have demonstrated that. And this whole thing about, you know, let's do what the dictator down in Chile did with Milton Friedman. What's so astounding to me is how often the Wikipedia pages and the other histories on that have been rewritten. But in any case, it's privatization of Social Security has never actually been accomplished, and the efforts to do so have been, shall we say, of mixed success at best. Scott, thanks for the call. Rich in Aurora, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. I hear you're talking about how warm it was in the studio. It was 72 here in Denver yesterday, and we got snow today. About
90
degrees.
Welcome to global weirding.
Talk about a shock to the system. Hey, you know, one of the things that with that guy Peter Ferrara, I would have asked him, and I would have pointed out what the last caller said. Well, if that's so great in Chile, how come the country went bankrupt? And I would have asked him, all right, I want you to tell me specifically what studies those were that he said, all these studies since the 80s, you know, that he talked about.
No, they've engineered a few. I've seen them, Rich, and you can find them on both sides. The point, what I was trying to solicit, and I think I did successfully, was are you guys happy that that finally you have a Democratic president who is shooting Santa Claus? After Democratic president after Democratic president has resisted the urge, although Bill Clinton did shoot the Santa Claus of welfare of the Great Society, any welfare as we know it, which seemed to work out very well for a year or two during the bubble. But now that the bubble is gone and people are genuinely in need, that program is causing great chaos because after 5 years, you know, women and children, single mothers, unemployed single mothers are just totally, you know, out of luck. It's so sad.
Do you think, you know, I was going to talk about Thatcher, but, you know, do you think that the president is biding time until 2014 when we get the Republicans out and the control back in on his side? Because he's tried to work with them since Christ was a child, and all they do is bite his hand.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's got to submit a budget. I understand he's playing into their theory, shooting, you know, Jude Winiski, but do you think he might be trying to wait until they take back, you know, Congress?
He might be thinking he is, and I think his advisors might be thinking he is, but I think that he has crossed a bridge too far, personally. Time will tell. I hope I'm wrong. I genuinely hope I'm wrong. Rich, thanks for listening to AM 760 there in Denver. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one of our callers today is going to get a free signed copy of my book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, brought to you by Stamps.com. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. All's well?
Yeah?
Okay. I thought there was a live read there. So anyway, Welcome back. Troy in Bellevue, Ohio, you don't... Oh, hang on just a second, Tammy. I'm sorry. I knew that there was something. Senator Tammy Baldwin is on the line with us, U.S. Senator
Hi.
From Wisconsin. Hi. Thank you so much for joining us. Baldwin.
Delighted.
Baldwin.senate.gov, of course, the website. And I understand this is Equal Pay Day, and you're calling
it
for support for the Paycheck for Fairness Act. Senator Baldwin, welcome to the program. And what's up with this?
Well, on Equal Pay Day, we're trying to raise awareness about some of the policies that we still need to put in place in order to try to close the wage gap that exists between women and men in this country. It's been something that's plagued us for decades and decades, and now that women are nearly half the workforce, this has a huge impact on growing our middle class. It has huge impacts on retirement security. There's a significant wage gap that's plagued us for decades. It's time to get the tools in place to close it.
How do you respond to the people from, for example, the Independent Women's Forum who come on this program with some regularity and say, oh, but, you know, those women, they want to have that flexibility so that they can go home and have babies. So if their pay is a little lower, that's the reasonable trade-off for that. Or because they occasionally leave the workplace to have children and then come back in, when you average their lifetime pay, of course it's going to be lower, those kinds of things.
Well, the facts don't bear those arguments out at all. And what we're talking about, in the 60s, we finally passed the Equal Pay Act, where if you're working side by side somebody with the same experience, the same responsibilities at the job, you ought to be paid the same. And we're still talking about that. What we've been able to track for, as I said, decades now, is unequal pay for equal responsibility and experience on the job. Years ago we also talked about comparable pay for comparable work when you're looking at whole classifications of female-dominated professions and male-dominated professions. But, those are really distractions that are thrown out. We're talking about getting the same compensation if you have the same level of experience, same level of responsibility in jobs.
Why would any billionaire fund an organization or a think tank to put out the kind of information that there's nothing to worry about, women prefer, making 70 cents on the dollar because of the, so-called flexibility, blah-de-blah. What's in it for them? I don't get where these folks come from. And why is this even called a conservative position?
Yeah, I mean, you asked me to put myself in someone's brain that I really don't understand. So it's a tricky question in that. I mean, people have opposed these efforts for years. Sometimes it comes from their views of the role of women in the world or the role of women in the economy. But they got to get with the program because today, as I mentioned earlier, women are 50% of the workforce. And families rely on the wages and salaries of women to make ends meet. We know that the middle-class wages in America, certainly in my home state of Wisconsin, have been stagnant. In fact, we're losing ground. And when you have in Wisconsin a very stubborn, women get 78 cents for every dollar paid to a man, and it's been sort of in that range for stubbornly for decades, that's a pay gap of over $10,000 for a woman who's working full-time. That's significant money right now in such a stressed economy when families are trying to make ends meet and maybe put a little aside for retirement or the children's college fund, et cetera. These are real dollars, and they are very significant to the well-being of our families and our middle class.
Yeah, not to mention the impact that they'll have when that woman retires and is on Social Security.
Exactly.
So are there any... any markers out there that we can use? Any other countries that I know, for example, in Norway, they 40% of their parliament is female by law, I believe. A large number of women, very politically active in Iceland. We did our show from there for a week. I don't know if it's the consequence of a mandate or what the right-wingers would call a quota of some sort, or just that's historically been a matrilineal society, or a matriarchal, more of a matriarchal society, somewhat less than us anyway, or more so than us. Are there examples out there that we should be looking at or to?
Well, there's certainly been leaders in the private sector and the public sector on these issues. You know, it's interesting you should ask me this question, because actually this was the first public policy issue I ever worked on as a newly minted college graduate. When I got a position in Wisconsin looking at the issue of comparable worth. But you can actually study your workforce and study and compare certain job classifications and push forward policies to mandate and demand equity. Now, we don't necessarily expect that all private sector entities are going to do this, but what the Paycheck Fairness Act does is at least gives individuals who might be injured by discriminatory pay schemes to have the tools to fight back. And that's really as simple as what we're looking at right now. You know, the Lilly Ledbetter Law was the first step, and this is the companion step.
Correct me if my numbers are wrong. This is just purely from recollection, and it's at probably at least a year old. But my recollection is that the average net worth of an intact white family in the United States is in the $70,000 or $80,000, that the average net worth of an intact African-American family in the United States is in the neighborhood of around $5,000, and that the average net worth of a white woman, single white woman, in the workforce in the United States is under $2,000, and of a woman of color is actually net negative. Whether those numbers are accurate to the dollar, I'm pretty sure that that spread is pretty real. And it reflects in some ways, you know, the social capital, this, you know, women it could not even vote in the United States until, you know, 90 years ago. And were pretty much the property of their husbands until 100 years ago. African Americans were the property of whites until slightly before that. What do we do about that? And what are your thoughts on those? And how do we also bring women of color into this conversation?
Well, these are great questions, and let me just say a couple of things. I've been studying and sort of trying to dig fairly deeply into not so much the net worth of Wisconsin families of various demographic backgrounds, but more average family wage or annual salary. And so the statistics you just did by memory comport very closely to what I've just been looking at in terms of just annual differences. And, you know, it's something we have to be very concerned about. What I would point to is, for example, take one of the biggest the biggest city in the state of Wisconsin. And that's the city of Milwaukee, formerly a huge, industrial city, a lot of manufacturing, jobs, that created a vibrant and healthy black middle class in the years after World War II. And then as so many of those manufacturing jobs were offshored, most recent to be hired were the first to be laid off. And so you saw a crippling effect in certain Milwaukee neighborhoods. Likewise, women didn't start joining the workforce in huge numbers until, you know, the 70s and 80s. And if you look at women joining the workforce, is the story of why the middle class didn't start contracting a decade or two earlier. But again, when you have huge recessionary impacts like we've just had, if the female, you know, the female workforce is some of the more recently hired in terms of, you know, jobs where you have long tenure. Again, there's are the individuals who might be the first to be let go. And so I think, you know, it varies a lot, but there's whether it's the more distant underpinnings of discrimination in our country and in our nation's history or the more recent ones.
Yeah. So they're more fragile.
They compound the impact of rough economic times.
Right. We have about a half a minute left here. I'm sorry, the tyranny of the clock here. What solutions do you suggest?
Well, on the very specific issue of equal pay for equal work, I am using this day to highlight the need to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act. But on the need to grow the middle class again, boy, there's a lot of strategies. Raise the minimum wage, bring manufacturing back, start making things in America again. We have a lot of strategies that we ought to be pushing full throttle.
You are singing my song. Senator Tammy Baldwin, the great state of Wisconsin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out our website at baldwin.senate.gov. Senator Tammy Baldwin. We'll be right back. So, Jacob Dean. Remember Jacob Dean? Jacob was our associate producer here, ran our board. He was on the air with me from time to time. He's been around for a long, long time. He's back in Portland. And there's this petition, a scholarship competition for Net Roots Nation that Democracy for America is putting on. And I went over there today and voted for Jacob that he could, because Jacob's not a wealthy guy. And so that he could be sent to this Net Roots Nation and do his radio show. He's got a weekly radio show now, his unfiltered radio show. But you can learn all about it over at NN13. NancyNancy13.democracyforamerica.com. DemocracyForAmerica.com. NN13. NN13.democracyforamerica.com. And vote for whoever you think is best and you prefer. My personal vote is for Jacob, who's a dear friend and followed us here to Washington, D.C. And then a family crisis took him back to Oregon, which is where he is now. And I think he's one of the rising stars in Progressive Talk Radio, and would love to see that happen. So, if I may give a shameful plug, just done. Troy in Bellevue, Ohio. Hey, Troy.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Your guest you had on earlier about privatizing Social Security, I have to agree with him. But I'm not an advocate of handing over my money to Goldman Sachs. I'm more of an advocate of providing my own financing for my own Social Security. And here's why, Tom. What concerns me the most about that is that I think there's a misconception that our Social Security is fully funded when it has $2.7 trillion worth of IOUs right now. And
Troy, have you ever invested?
Yes, I invest all my own money.
Okay, so you ever bought a bond?
No, I do not have bonds right now. They're not paying anything.
Yeah, but if they were, would you?
Depending on the company, if I did the research and I felt like they were.
What if it was a bond in the United States of America, the arguably the safest bonds in the world right now?
Arguably.
Okay.
But
that's your IOU. I mean, that's where Social Security is invested. What's wrong with that?
No. Because, and I'm going to assume this, and my assumption could be wrong, but once the baby boomers all start retiring, the current workforce today isn't going to be able to fund all those people who are retiring, and all that surplus money that the government is taking and returning us an IOU won't be there.
Okay, Troy, let me give you a Social Security 101, because I think you're missing a little bit of history here. When Social Security started in 1935, the people who were retired, 100% of the money that it cost to pay for their retirements, and every year it changed, by the way, was taken from people who were working. So the tax was 1.1%, 1.2%, 1.3%, you know, whatever it would be from year to year to year to year. And there was no Social Security Trust Fund, none whatsoever. It was, you know, FIFO or LIFO or whatever it is, money in, money out, and that was how it went. In the early 70s, Ronald Reagan, to his credit, saw, and he wasn't the only one who saw it, I mean, everybody was seeing it, that the baby boomers were going to be retiring in about 20 or 30 years, and it was going to be like a python going through a rabbit. And that if only the people who were retiring in 2010 and in 2020 and in 2030, if only those people who were working in those years were paying for all of those boomer retirees, which was, you know, a significant fraction of the workforce, then the tax, the individual tax, would have to go up to 20-25% rather than the 3.5-4% that it was at that time. And so what? So Reagan called a commission together. Alan Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan headed it up. Moynihan, the Democrat from Connecticut, as I recall. Alan Greenspan, the Republican from Crazyville. And I shouldn't put him down like that. And these guys did a good work. And what they said was, okay, let's do something here that has never been done before with Social Security. Up until 1982, every penny that went out of Social Security into retirees had come into Social Security that very year from working people. So they said, starting in 82 and ending sometime around 2035, we're going to double tax the boomers. We're going to double pay. They will be the first and only generation of Americans who not only are going to pay for their parents' retirement, the way it had been working since 1935, but they're also going to pay for their own retirement. And we're going to take that money from them. We're going to set it aside in a trust fund. We're going to invest it in a very, very safe place in treasury bills that will return, you know, maybe 1-1.5%. But it's still, you know, it's a safe investment. And they did that. And that surplus is now $2.7 trillion. And the way the system is designed, and it took from 1982 until now to go from zero, which is where it used to be, to $2.7 trillion. And from now, actually, it's going to be at about 2 years, Social Security is going to start paying out that $2.7 trillion as the boomers start to retire. And there was that generation that was double taxed, that paid not only for their parents but also for themselves. They're going to start getting that money back. And sometime, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, that $2.7 trillion is going to go down to zero, which is where it should be. And presumably by that time, there'll be enough new workers in the workforce that the ratios will be more reasonable and Social Security can go back to simply funding itself. And if we simply said right now, instead of only collecting Social Security taxes on the first $113,000 of income, if instead we collected it on everybody's income, rich people as well, that Social Security fund would be solvent forever. So that's the piece of information that you've been missing, Troy. That trust fund is the double taxation of the boomers for the boomers, and it is supposed to go away. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the news and information from Wall Street, Main Street, everywhere in between to help you win the water cooler wars. Plus more stimulating talk radio, Viagra for your brain without the stiff thinking. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get over to free-don.org, pdamerica.org, MoveToAmend.org. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.